It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Today's show is dedicated entirely to two of the most impressive people I've recently met, who are both military veterans whose lives are deeply linked to the outdoors as well as to their military service. We'll be hearing from Kirk Alkire, who has made climbing in the Chugach Mountains a form of therapy for himself and other grieving veterans and families. He recently got a mountain named Gold Star Peak. And I'll talk with David Schumann, who retired from a long career as a pararescuer, doing the most difficult and daring rescues in Alaska's wilderness, and now uses his skills as a heliskiing guide and as a mountain rescue trainer. Both these guys have fascinating stories to go along with the amazing service they rendered to our country. Stick with us as we talk with veterans on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Media's audio outdoor magazine. In the studio with me right now is Kirk Alkire. Kirk spent 23 years in the U.S. Army, retired as a first sergeant, still works for the Army as a civilian. But this is an outdoor show. We're talking, what I want to talk to him about is this amazing thing that he's done to honor veterans, honor the people we've lost in our serving our country. He has climbed a mountain called Mount POW/MIA many, many, many times as part of his mission to honor and remember and heal, because Kirk also spent time in Iraq and some pretty terrible things that he witnessed and was part of in honoring those people, and recently has gotten a mountain named Mount Gold Star. Just recently, it was officially named, right, Kirk?
That's correct. Gold Star Peak.
Gold Star Peak. And where is it located?
It's just north of Eagle River, off of Lake Iklutna Road.
Oh, that's so great. So, just to start with, I mean, you climbed Mount POW/MIA countless times.
Absolutely.
What was the first, how did you first come to do that? When, I mean, it was quite a while ago, right?
It was. Actually, a junior ROTC program out in the Valley has climbed at Colony. A junior ROTC program has climbed it for a number of years and replaced the flag at the summit as part of a summer project that the instructors or the teachers would take their students, the ROTC students, up to participate in.
Huh, neat. So when do you recall the first time you climbed it? It's been a long time.
It's been a while. It's been quite a while. I'm not exactly sure. It's early 2000s.
Yeah, and you've climbed it so many times since. There's no way you could count them, right?
No. Now there's a significant logbook that's up on the summit that all visitors log. So there's quite a few signatures of mine and my friends on that summit.
Yeah. So orient people as to where this mountain is.
Well, it's just, if you're familiar with the Glen Highway headed northbound, just before you cross the Kinnick River Bridge, to your right is, off which would be to your south, is Twin Peaks. And just a little bit further to the west of that is Mount POW/MIA. And it sits, it's a long bench that sits just looking, pointed almost directly at Denali.
Hmm, neat. And tell me about the climb. What's it like?
It's a 3,000-foot gain in elevation that's packed into just a little under a mile and three quarters.
Right. So it's very steep.
It's very steep. Not too much of a scramble, but it is from the very first step you take, it's up.
Uh-huh. How long does it normally take you to do it? I suppose it's different kinds of year, right?
Different times of year, it's absolutely different. Summertime, I've been up there and we've gotten down to a little less than an hour and,
wow,
and 40 minutes right around there.
You're in good shape.
I try to, but some of my friends and my son, matter of fact, they make it kind of tough. So I'm chasing them up.
Yeah, there you go. And but you go up in inclement weather. You go up all times of the year, right?
All times of the year. I just was up it last week. So it was the first recorded ascent of the and summit of the newly federally recognized Gold Star Peak.
Oh, that's neat. So where is Gold Star Peak?
Gold Star Peak sits to the northwest of Mount POW MIA. So it's on the front side of the ridge in front of Mount POW MIA, but off to the left, mm-hmm. or the west.
So when you talk about replacing this flag, how often do you have to go up there to do that?
Well, almost every time we climb it, we replace it because the winds coming off the lake, Aglutinah Lake, and back in the valley there, come right up over the top of that peak and it really tears it up pretty good. So every time we climb it, we bring a replacement flag. So there's two flags that are actually flying there. It's the American flag on the top, and then right below that is the POW-MIA flag, mm-hmm. which is attached to a flagpole that is sitting up there.
Yeah. So do you do this like once a year or a couple times a year? How often do you do it?
Several times. I think I've already climbed it four times this year.
Wow. And we're only recording like here at the end of February.
Right. And I did it.
Wow. So that's like every couple of weeks.
It has been recently. I closed out January and climbed it on the 29th of, December. Closed out the 2017. Mm-hmm. And climbed it right at the very end of December as well.
Okay. Wow. So let's talk about why this is so important to you. You were mentioning to me that you were deployed to Iraq at kind of some of the hairiest and most dangerous time there during the surge, mid-2000s, and you were leading troops in battle.
Absolutely. I was part of the 4th Brigade Combat Team of the 25th Infantry Division, airborne out of Fort Richardson, Alaska, now called J-Bear. On their first combat deployment for that brigade, the first one that they conducted in 2006 and 2007. We were deployed just south of Baghdad into what was referred to as the Iron Triangle, right during the height of the surge. We went there and we were sent there for 15 months.
And what was your mission exactly?
Well, it was restoring order.
Right. Everything had kind of come apart, hadn't it?
Absolutely. And winning the hearts and minds of a lot of the local populace there, and restored electricity, water, sewage. Many projects, civil affairs type projects, were happening there. At the same time, there was also quite a bit of insurgents in the area conducting operations against us.
Mm-hmm. So you lost some friends over there.
My brigade, the 425, as we're called for short, we lost in that 15 months 53 paratroopers that were assigned to our brigade.
Incredible. Incredible. Just such a sacrifice.
Absolutely. And they come from all across America, all different parts of America. Those soldiers, those leaders were serving here in Alaska, but their homes were spread across the United States.
Yeah, yeah. So these were some guys that you knew pretty well, some of them.
Some best friends. And some of the soldiers that I trained, I lost a leader. One of my platoon leaders was actually part of one of the operations was killed in action as well. We lost quite a few.
So a lot of healing to do from that kind of experience.
Absolutely. We talk about the healing, and there's a lot of people do different things for therapy. Take to the outdoors, fishing, hiking. It's one thing that I get a lot of healing for me. Personal healing for me is to spend time in the mountains and the outdoors. And what better place to do it than right here? I live in Eagle River. And it doesn't take me but a couple minutes to be off on my own and up on a mountain. Mm-hmm. So Absolutely.
So we this POW/MIA aspect of it, I think of that in terms of Vietnam, but you were mentioning to me that some of your guys have been captured as well over in Iraq.
Absolutely. 20 January 2007 was a horrific day for our brigade, my unit in particular. We had some insurgents that had came into Iraq from Iran, and they dressed in American soldiers' outfits and drove some vehicles that they had stolen to make them look like they were some contractors type people. Anyways, they came in and they raided the, it's called the PJCC. It's the Provincial Joint Communications Center in Karbala, Iraq. And it was there that they stormed the location and instantly killed one of my guys and injured a number of others, and then took four POW and took them from that location as prisoners and drove off into the countryside of near Karbala.
Wow, what a nightmare.
It was a terrible day, terrible event. And at that remote location, my soldiers were then taken out of the vehicle because we were trying to catch these guys.
You're pursuing them?
We had assets that were pursuing them and trying to find them. And they sensed that we were probably getting close. And so they took our guys out and they executed each of them before leaving that location and disappearing into the countryside, if you will.
Right. And just another seemingly senseless insurgency operation during this chaotic period when we're trying to pacify the area, and there's just this constant struggle there.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you don't want to forget that. I mean, because this guy's made the ultimate sacrifice for their country, regardless of the outcome of things, right?
Absolutely. They were, it affected so many of my guys, myself included, and they were America's brightest.
Yeah.
They were the best of the best. And so it's a tough thing for still this many years later.
I'm sure. And I really appreciate you sharing it with us, because I feel like the country, and especially Alaska, honors veterans and honors the military. But I feel like a lot of these stories never really got told. We never really knew what was going on over there, for whatever reason. It just was not depicted in any kind of way that hit home, other than just the numbers.
Right. And, the paper, you'd see one here, one there, maybe two, three or something. But when you put it into the contents of I have here with me the ID tags of all 53 soldiers.
Oh, my gosh.
And when people hold on to these and touch them and look at the names, it really does hit them. And it puts it into a different context, because it's not reading the newspaper or just hearing the 5 o'clock news that one soldier died today.
Yeah. So these are all the ones from the brigade in Alaska.
Correct. All 53 that I mentioned.
It's shocking.
It is. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I'm going to take a picture and we'll put that on our website so people can see just the visual impact of all those tags.
Right. And so with me, it hurts, it's painful, but at the same time, I'm honored to share their story. And it's really, it feels good to hear from somebody or show these and they know the name on there, mm-hmm. they're related to, or even some of my own personal friends and soldiers that served with some of these. It's a powerful moment, and I take them everywhere I go.
So
every mountain I climb or adventure I take place in or take part of, I bring them with me to honor them.
Those are the tags that came from those guys. They're always with you.
They are, and it's not the mm-hmm. actual tag that they mm-hmm. wear. What I've done is I've had these created, and it has their rank that they are, their first and middle initial, last name, and then the unit they were assigned to, and then the date of their loss. And so mm-hmm. on these, they're all in order as to the first casualty we took and all the way to the last before we came back home.
Wow. It's Outdoor Explorer. We are talking about something a bit more intense than we usually do when we're talking about the outdoors, but it's really an important topic. Kirk Alkire is here. He's retired from the U.S. Army. He was a first sergeant, was in for 23 years, and now has really dedicated a lot of his life to honoring the veterans and the people who gave their lives for our country. Kirk, when you came back, you'd already been climbing POW/MIA, but you came back after this experience. It must have meant a lot more all of a sudden, huh?
Absolutely. It very much did. It took on a completely different meaning for me. I no longer think about, how tough any climb is or any single adventure that I undertake. I never think about that anymore, especially when I'm carrying them with me and I have them in my pack.
So, yeah. Yeah. So, and you mentioned that sort of the therapy that you get from being outdoors, part of it is just like being out there and the beauty of it and everything, but also maybe because you're doing something that is physical and real, right?
Yes. And, the solitude of it. And, very rarely, I could probably, this past summer, I think was one of the first times that I can possibly remember that I ever even ran into anybody except for sheep up on that mountain. So that's another reason I'm really drawn to it. It's a challenge and it doesn't see a lot of traffic.
Yeah.
It's not like Flat Top or mm-hmm. or something that's a wonderful climb. It's just that
I'm not sure people know where it is for the most part.
Right. And it is a little bit of a challenge to find.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That is what makes it kind of a unique and special place.
And you're up there climbing it basically every couple of weeks.
It's turned out to be that.
Yeah.
Yes. And
yeah.
Those that do climb it will, when they see, we installed a new summit box up there this uh-huh. past spring. It needed a new one. And we put a new summit box in there that has a lot of neat information about exactly what we're talking about on to include the summit logbook
mm-hmm.
with some the names of people that have come up there and done the exact same thing, honored our fallen.
That's great. Missing. So, and then you had the idea to have a Mount Gold Star or Gold Star Peak separate from POW/MIA. Where did that idea come from, and how do you pick the peak?
Well, history dictates that almost every POW or service member that was captured and held by the enemy was ultimately either killed or, never made it home. Through the technology that we have nowadays, this DNA process and new search techniques and whatnot, we've been able to identify the remains of some of those POWs and or those that were missing in action.
MIA is a pretty unusual thing to happen these days.
Yes, with the technology that we have, it's pretty tough.
Mm-hmm.
So I, through that process, when a person that is POW or MIA, they can go years and years and years, and that family just never knows what happened to their loved one.
Right.
Are they still alive? Are they dead? Are they, where are they? And so when that process does happen and they do make a positive identification and bring that fallen service member back home, that family then turns into a Gold Star.
Right.
So my connection, standing on the peak past last spring, I believe it was, or maybe a little bit earlier, was that this is a perfect place because the two are so very connected. POWs almost always turned into Gold Stars.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't necessarily take away from the fact that somebody that was killed in action or died while serving their country did not turn into their families still became Gold Stars. But I found the very much connection with my own personal experience with POWs, MIAs, as well as the Gold Star connection.
Right, right. So the mountain is nearby.
Correct.
Yeah.
It is, you actually will pass Gold Star Peak before you get to Mount POW MIA.
Okay.
And we're not trying to take away from POW or make one,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So what was the process to get this done? I mean, was it easy? Was it kind of take a while or?
It is a rather lengthy process. It starts with an application to the federal government back in D.C., which then sends that application to the state that owns the land where it's going to be named. And at that time, they solicit the public. They're looking for information about it, whether or not the state or the landowner, the community that is around it is okay with it. And with that, they asked me at the same time to help the process get the public's opinion, which included asking elected officials, asking the local Native community, see what their thoughts were, if they would like that or would agree with naming it.
I bet there wasn't a single person who opposed this.
No, well, yeah, you're right. And with that also, I had a petition signed and I had a resolution signed by the city of Palmer. And the petition actually, interestingly, started with just here in Alaska. We'll pass around a petition and see what people think. That quickly spread to the lower 48. And by the end of it, we had over 1,500 signatures.
Wow.
From all 50 states, including 4 countries and 1 U.S. territory.
Oh, that's great.
So the support came from a very large number of Gold Star families spread in almost every 50 state, or all 50 states, excuse me.
That's great. And so then the actual designation is like a law that passes or something, or a regulation that passes?
Correct. Well, during that process, the state then has the Alaska board met in December. They meet every 3 months, and the federal board meets monthly. So my application didn't make it for the summer process, or the summer cycle, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So it later, it popped up, and I was told that, Kirk, it's going to be in December. So we attended the hearing here in Anchorage. I brought with me a number of veterans as well as Gold Star family members, and we came and watched the process unfold where the directors on that commission ultimately approved it and packaged that packet up and sent it to D.C. for them to make their decision. That board met February 8th of this year and
approved it.
Approved it. Myself,
yeah.
I flew back to D.C. for the process, and it was an unbelievable thing to take part of and watch our government at work. And
you've got something to actually work through our government.
Right.
So that's amazing.
Yeah, it was. It was quite a neat experience.
That's great. So will there be something there that will, you know, show that this is Mount Gold Star, other than like sort of a cross on the map, or how will that be known?
Two things. It'll be all publications at the federal state level will be included on the maps whenever those maps, that next cycle of maps, come out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how that works, but
right.
It'll actually go into the geographic names or the database that will have it listed in there. And then also through that process, I applied for a grant to build a monument from the state of Alaska. I applied for a grant under the Veterans Endowment or Veterans Memorial Fund, and the grant was approved.
Oh, great.
The state awarded me the grant to take care of the monies associated with building the monument. I said that I didn't want to be part of the design or what the wording would say on the monument. I said it would be awesome if a Gold Star took part of that. and mm-hmm. or Gold Stars in the community here designed it. Mm-hmm. And I got a call from a gentleman, a Gold Star father in Eagle River, that called me and stated he had just the person for me. She does it for a living. She designs or parks, trails, and whatnot for the municipality of Anchorage, and said that she would love to take part of the project. And turns out she's a Gold Star as well.
Oh, so wow.
She's going to take care of designing the memorial that's going to go up on the summit.
It's going to be right on top of the mountain.
Right on top of the peak.
Oh, great.
And her design, we're working on it right now. So mm-hmm. That process is...
how much money did you get for the grant?
It was $5,000.
Well, you should be able to do something. And of course, you're going to have to carry all the concrete and everything up this mountain.
Well,
right?
I mentioned the same thing, and once you know it, somebody said, why would you carry it when we can just donate a helicopter to you? So, we've got a helicopter that's going to help.
You're getting the sense that people really care about this.
They do, and I think... They recognize it's long overdue, mm-hmm. I think. Me personally, I think it is. And somebody here in the state had mentioned that it couldn't have been at a better place because an estimated 50,000 cars drive by it daily.
Yeah, right.
And not to mention the summer when all the tourists will be driving by it as well.
But it's going to be up on top of the mountain.
It is.
That's what I love about this, right? Because to me, sometimes if something's just sitting in a pullout,
right,
it's a little bit less meaningful because somebody's driving by and they're throw a cigarette out the window or whatever.
Right.
But up on a mountain, you have to really want to get there, right?
You have to work to get it.
Yeah.
But with that also, we're going to, because not everybody can physically make mm-hmm. it, we're going to acquire some land from the state. We're working on that as well right now, but get a piece of land where we are going to put a monument for those that might not be able to, that can't physically climb or just would rather not. It'll still be a place where they can go and reflect, look at the mountain, and reflect and remember.
So it'll be within sight. And
absolutely.
Yeah, great.
So we've got a couple spots in that we're working on right now, but... we're really excited about that.
This is a wonderful thing. I just think I just know people really are, have got to be really feeling good about this because you want to, I mean, it just really needs to be a marker like you're talking about that it's permanent and that really shows the respect and the thought on that we have about this.
Absolutely. And our Gold Stars, we've got a couple different, there's quite a few in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope this, for those that, you know, there are some that would probably rather not talk about it, but there
mm-hmm,
are quite a few more that are so very proud of the service of their loved one that this process is about remembering those fallen by honoring their survivors.
Yeah. So tell us about if folks want to climb either or both mountains. How do you get to the trail or what's the trail?
It doesn't have an official trailhead with a parking lot and a map board and all that, mm-hmm. but there are a couple different ways to get there. You can take it from, you could come up from the south side, basically from Eklutna Lake and go up towards, Twin Peaks,
mm-hmm.
The Twin Peaks Trail and come around that way. That's one way. A shorter way is to come up from the west side, which is off of Lake Eklutna Road at about mile 5, it's basically you just
got to do some bushwhacking,
have to go up. And so around mile 5 in through there, there's places where you can begin to just
break through the bushes,
go up. Absolutely.
Yeah. Huh. Wow. So would you like to see an official trail or do you kind of like it this way?
Well, there's been some talk about that and it's kind of goes both ways. I have guided, if mm-hmm. you will, a number of people to the summit. I've also know a number of people that never found it.
Right.
So I am more than happy to help people get up there.
Mm-hmm.
But it just have to keep going up.
Right. And,
there is a spot where you do a trail does break out, and you mm-hmm. get to see that it's basically just continues up.
There's a route. Is it something that you can do without any technical equipment? You could hike up there?
Correct. It's non-technical. I just did it just a week ago, I guess it was now. And
and we're pre-recording, but that would have been like late February.
Correct. Yeah. Late February. We had to wear, crampons. There's quite a bit of ice built up in there, but it also is a pretty dangerous. You have to really kind of know how to read and understand the avalanche condition and pay attention to the warnings. But it was a good day. It was not a problem. We were able to get up. So non-technical. However, with the ascent and the gain in elevation, most of us have agreed that it is a moderate to difficult hike.
Yeah, and probably better to do in the summertime.
It is better in the summer. However, there is no water source, and so it just you just really have to kind of pay attention.
Got it. Well, thanks, Kirk. I'm so glad you did this, and it just is an inspiration, really, that you have devoted yourself to this, and so thank you from the entire community.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
So we've been hearing from Kirk Alkire, who is retired from the Army and has really devoted himself to honoring these Gold Star families and these folks who gave their lives for our country. And do you have a website or a way that people could contact you and support what you're doing?
We have a Facebook page that's very active right now. It's called Gold Star Peak Alaska, and that's the first one. And then we will have there's a email link in there if somebody wants to reach out to me.
Great. Well, we'll link to that from outdoorexplorer.org so folks can find it.
Okay.
All right. Great. Well, stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Charles Wolforth, it's Outdoor Explorer, and my guest now is David Schumann, who is a pretty amazing skier and mountaineer who spent 25 years in the military as a pararescuer and then parlayed that career into a career as a mountain guide all over the world and a powder skiing guy here in Alaska. And I was just really excited to get together with David and learn about being a pararescuer and what that entails, and learning the skills he's got and then how he's using them now. So thanks a lot for coming in, David.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
You're just back from Nepal, where you were training Sherpas, which sounds really interesting and really amazing. Training Sherpas to be safer in the mountains?
I was. The Alex Lowe Foundation is this foundation that's put together to provide training for high-altitude workers so they can work safer at altitude. And they put on a course once a year where they bring Sherpas from all over Nepal, and they provide training. There's a basic and an advanced course. And it's fascinating. Like the basic course, it's 13 days, and it's all about safe movement through the mountains. And then once they graduate that, they can apply for the advanced course. In the advanced course, we're doing multi-pitch partner rescue, client rescue, and the students are amazing. I had 8 students. A couple of them had been on Everest a couple of times. One of them had walked 7 days from his village to get to the school to take the training. We had, I think, 90 students total between both the classes and a total of 13 days of training for graduation. It was a great experience.
So that sounds like really interesting, kind of amazing work. And it's not the first thing I would think of about like a veteran who is retired, right? But your career in the military was like pretty unique.
My career was fascinating. I did two services. I spent 8 years in the Marine Corps in Force Recon and then taught at the Mountain Warfare Training Center. And then I cross-trained into the Air Force, into pararescue, a very small career field, about 350 people, and where you're specialist in rescue for the Department of Defense. And then just so happens on this team in Alaska, which is unique in its own right also, because of Alaska being so vast and limited road systems and resources, the military does conducts rescue for the state as well. So being up here as a pararescueman,
you're really busy.
You're busy. You know, we'd average like a mission a week, and that's everything from a plane crash to a hiker, climber. It could be a cargo vessel 300 miles off the coast with a Panamanian, you know, sailor with a heart attack. And so it was a fascinating career field. And all those skills that I got from the military, like a lot of the military skills, maybe don't transition always to that civilian job. And for me, they transitioned perfectly right to my passions, you know, skiing and climbing and travels.
Did you start out being a skier and somebody who wanted to do this kind of mountain stuff before you entered the military? Or is that something you kind of got as were assigned to that unit?
You know, I did not. When I grew up in Northern California, a small town of Paradise, I didn't have skiing or climbing close by, and I wasn't exposed to it until I went to the military. And it was actually in the Marine Corps. Originally, I was a surfer. I surfed all over the Southern California into Mexico. I loved surfing. I went to Australia and Bali. But when I got stationed up at Bridgeport at that Mount Warfare Training Center, exposed me to climbing, to skiing, and it just kind of redirected really the rest of my life. From there, that became my pursuit in those forms of outdoor. I still surf, but now really skiing and climbing are the two passions I chase.
The balance translates, doesn't it, from surfing to skiing?
It does translate, yeah.
So tell me about being a pararescuer. I think that folks who spend time outdoors in Alaska kind of view these pararescuers as being guardian angels and also being sort of the best of the best. I mean, you guys really have to know what you're doing. What kind of training do you go through, and how do you develop the skills to go out into these really hairy situations?
The pararescue career field, super small, 350 or so, and they have a mission of conducting rescue for the Department of Defense, and a motto that these things we do that others may live. The training is quite extensive. It's a 2-year pipeline.
Wow.
And to even get into the pipeline, you have to take a physical agility test. And there could be, you know, hundreds of youth that take the test. And those that pass it then start that next process.
So it's kind of an elite of an elite.
Oh, it does. It gets down to like the NDOC, which is that first course. You get into the NDOC, it's 10 weeks. And my class started with 112 and we graduated 9.
Wow.
And of the 9, 3 of them had already gone through 2 or 3 times before. And then that 12, that 9 went off into the finish the pipeline. Then there's jump school, free fall, dive, survival, helicopter egress.
Dive, scuba diving.
Scuba diving, yeah.
Free fall sounds a little scary. What's that all about?
Skydiving, military free fall. Okay. Civilian-wise would be skydiving. Mm-hmm. Survival school, your paramedic license, all your medical training. And then you wrap it all up at the apprenticeship course in New Mexico, where you do nothing but tactics, and you apply all those skills, jumping in, parachuting into scenarios.
Which could be behind enemy lines or something.
Mm-hmm. Could be behind enemy lines. And then finally, at the end of this 2 years, you graduate with a very small, we only have a couple graduations a year, and then you get assigned to a team. And then you go to this team thinking that, you know, you're most highly trained guy around, and you start the process over
because you're a newbie.
Yeah, you're the new guy, and there you go, and there's this folder waiting for you to go start your upgrade training and all those different aircraft and everything unique to that team. And especially here in Alaska, in this team, we have more glaciers, more mountaineering, more cold water diving. You know, it's a different than when we were diving in Southern California or Florida, right? There's a lot of other things you train for that specifically in that team. And then you upgrade, and then you're always training. Basically, as a PJ, you're always on alert, and when you're on alert, you're training. for the mission.
Wow. So the units that are elsewhere, they might be deployed to do rescues, you know, in Iraq or Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the time, they're not rescuing. They're just training. Here in Alaska, you're actually going on real rescues all the time.
But we average probably 1 week, and it's all over the board.
And that's helping you be ready for your military role, too.
Exactly. Yeah. It definitely was a benefit to have that alert commitment. Your gear is always packed, and to have that alert commitment here is, it's costly. Right? It costs a lot of people per day. You're busy, but to get those missions and is rewarding, right? Because you're doing it for your own state that you live in, and sometimes people you know.
Do they call you for a garden variety rescue or only for the really challenging ones?
There's a whole lot of, I'd say, legalities that go with that. Like the military can't interfere with an organization that gets paid, right? Like, let's say there was an accident on the Seward Highway, that'd be Life Flight, Life Guard, right? Those organizations. And there's an RCC, you got your state troopers. They're really
Coordination Center.
Yep, they're responsible for rescue for that state. So it goes out to whoever's responsible for that region. But if it's beyond their capabilities, then it would be kicked right back to that RCC, and then they would forward it on to us. So we're really that, we kind of have
sort of the line of last resort.
You got the line of last resort, and we have a lot of resources, kind of unlimited. So so once we get it, then we own it until it's complete, or we'll assist another organization. But usually we're not that first call. It has to go through its legalities and its processes.
So you mentioned something at sea. I would think the Coast Guard probably has some pretty amazing rescue capabilities, too. When would you need to help them?
They do, but they don't have air refueling. So with our aircraft, we have air refueling. So we could be parachuting 300 miles off the coast, and our aircraft can air refuel all the way out there to pick us
back up. Parachuting right into the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, we probably every couple of years we have one. Myself and a couple of teammates a few years back had parachuted about 350 miles off the coast to a 800-foot cargo vessel. It was a Panamanian flag vessel with a Filipino crew, and one of them was having a heart attack. So we parachuted at night in February.
Wow.
We have our own Zodiac that's packaged up with a parachute on it.
Okay.
Push that out of the aircraft, we parachute behind it, and once in the water, unbundle it. We have our own boat. We cruise over to the ship, and there's some heavy seas.
Getting on a cargo ship in the middle of the ocean, it's crazy.
At night, big swell, and we get aboard, and the sailor didn't survive, but because of the storm and the impending weather, we're there for 3 days running around the ship until we could get off. And that particular time, the Coast Guard got a ship close enough where they could come pick us up with a helicopter.
Yeah, because you can't launch a helicopter that far out into the ocean.
No, not unless it's one of the Air Force rescue ones with air refueling, in which case they would just drag a tanker and the helicopters and just keep refueling until it got to us. And that was the original plan.
Amazing. And do you high altitude rescue as well?
Do a lot of high altitude rescue. We the 212 has a handshake of this agreement with Park Service. They do patrols with the Denali Park Rangers. We get a lot of calls all the way into Canada. We've been all the way up into Greenland. Out in the Wrangles, there's not a whole lot of resources. So several years ago, there was a plane that crashed into a crevasse in the Wrangles. It was a white plane in a snowstorm about 10,000 feet. So us and some Canadian park rangers were searching these glaciers until we found it. We had to go into the crevasse to get them out of the plane.
Any survivors in that one?
There were two survivors, and it was fascinating. Andy Salters was a climber and author, wrote a book, Glacier Travel and Crevasse Rescue, and he was a survivor in that plane crash.
Wow.
And then I ran into him 2 years ago. I was down in Bishop teaching for Rigging for Rescue. I was teaching a rigging seminar to the local SAR team. And they were having a party there, and there he was. It was the first time we'd seen each other.
Wow.
It was fun to run into him.
I would think if I was him, I would never forget your face, because my airplane has crashed into a crevasse.
Mm-hmm.
Probably think I'm not going to survive.
Yeah.
And here's some guys who show up. Amazing.
In a crevasse and pull you out of a plane. And when I went after this party and we were talking, I was like, hey, last time I saw you, we were both in a crevasse inside a plane. And his eyes got big and we got to catch up. It was super fun to see him.
Wow. So how did you get there and get into the crevasse? I mean, the helicopter lands on the glacier, or do you have to hike in a lot?
Helicopters. We got a helicopter up to about 10, 10.5 somewhere, got off, built a bunch of rope systems, went into the crevasse about 60, 70 feet, went into the plane from there with our litters, and we were able to package the two survivors up and then raise them back out and then got them onto some Canadian planes. Helicopters flew them down to our rescue aircraft, which were lower on the glacier, and to Yakutat. We had a C-130 with more pararescue men on it, and then treated them all the way back to Anchorage.
So this sounds like really scary work, really challenging work, but also unbelievably rewarding work.
Super rewarding, and I don't know about scary, because I mean you're training, right? You're training for it all the time. You have teammates that are well trained, and you have resources, but very rewarding for sure.
Yeah. Well, and I'm going to want to hear a lot more about it. I've got to let people know this is Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. I'm talking with David Schumann, who is a mountain guide, skiing guide, and finished a 25-year career in the military, much of it as a PJ or a pararescuer here in Alaska. Did you guys get also deployed over to do rescue in the various conflicts in the Middle East?
For sure. Anytime there's a conflict, there's probably a rescue asset there. So we spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, in Africa, Iraq. I did three rotations over in Afghanistan doing rescue for the Department of Defense. And that includes even civilians, too. Did a lot of recovery of Afghans that get injured as well.
Mm-hmm. And I guess because you've developed these amazing skills, the military probably wants to keep you doing the same thing as long as possible.
Which is fantastic, right? In the Marine Corps at the time, when I was in Force Recon, you had to leave that specialty to go do career enhancement jobs. But in pararescue, you can stay in that career field for your whole career. And that's exactly what they want because of all the time and training they've put into you.
Right, right. So you decided at some point to retire, or had to retire because of the time you were there, and then made a transition into a new career.
You know, it was interesting. I went into the military at 17, 25 years later, retired. And yet, it's interesting. You have an identity crisis there.
Right, I imagine.
Right?
Yeah. And, you don't have helicopters and huge airplanes at your beck and call.
Not anymore. But, well, now I got more helicopters, right?
Right.
Just smaller ones. And and it took a little while, but now I've just redefined my identity again, right? Now it's more chasing my other passions. And you know, I work at Chugach Powder Guides as a heli ski guide, and it's an amazing company with amazing people, and it's an amazing job, right? Because you're taking people
Absolutely.
Into the mountains, showing this incredible terrain that we have, and you're having an amazing experience, and it's a fun, wonderful job. That's my winter recreating work, and then in the summer I work for this company called Rigging for Rescue, where I travel the country teaching rescue seminars related to ropes and the physics and math and techniques. And I do fire departments, military, volunteer rescue teams. And that has also opened up the doors all over the place to go to the Khumbu to teach the Sherpas. It's opened up the door. 2 years ago, I went climbing with Eric Weinmeier, the blind climber that was on Everest, climbed all seven summits.
Wow.
We came up to the Alaska Range, and myself, him, and Mike Gibbs went and climbed the west face couloir of Mount Huntington. And so that company has opened up the doors to even more fun adventures around the world.
Yeah. What a great life. Mm-hmm. So do you think that you're experience in the military and rescue made you a more cautious and thoughtful climber than you might otherwise have been, especially now that you're spending more time with sort of amateur climbers or climbers who don't have that, you know, lifetime of experience behind them?
Was it the military or was it age that's made me, there's with experience, right? You get experience from all over the place, and the military gave me a lot of experience. And I saw a lot of accidents, right? That's part of being rescued,
right,
recovering
absolutely.
These people from these events.
And thinking about how those accidents took place.
You get to see a different look of it, right, on the site. I think it has created my experience level is high because of those experiences. I feel that I have a good, well-rounded respect for the mountains and what can go wrong and try to avoid try to avoid those, me being in that situation myself.
You'd be the guy I'd want along if something did go wrong as well.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. So what kind of goals do you have after having such an amazing career and seeing so many great things? Do you think about, like, I've got to do that, I've got to do that? Or is it just more like just enjoying the outdoors because it's sort of part of your blood now?
You know, I don't have really big goals, but things keep popping up and I just keep chasing them. The Nepal climbing last year in Cholatse and Amma de Blom, and then the Kumbu climbing school. I think next year or this fall, me and Megan are rent a van and go rock climbing all through Europe for 6 weeks. And
nice.
So really, I don't think I have any major big goal out there, but more so, like, you're always, something catches your eye and all of a sudden you start piecing together that trip. And plus, going back to Nepal in this December, we're going to do another seminar at the Kumbu Climbing School. And this time we're going to do all the instructors. So we're about 20 Sherpa instructors and do an advanced level seminar for them. So when they do their course the next month with all the students from all over Nepal, they try to improve their instructor pool and just help out that mm-hmm. foundation.
Yeah, cool. So did you do any skiing when you were a PJ? I mean, that's not really part of being a PJ, is it?
It is, yeah.
Okay.
Think about rescue in Alaska, right? And all kinds of places and environments. Yes, we did ski. All of our teammates were issued skis, and we would go to Alyeska. We do backcountry trips. We did a lot of avalanche work.
What kind of skis does the military give you? I remember those old, like, wooden military skis.
We don't do those, no.
They give you good skis?
We give us good skis, yeah. Good skis, good gear. We are well outfitted, all right? We're a small specialty organization, yeah. And we are well outfitted and well trained. And we send all our guys to avalanche training because we park aircraft in big mountains, and we want to know we can put that aircraft someplace safe. We can travel through that
terrain. That would be if you didn't do that right?
Yeah. It's fascinating how I've been very lucky to have this outdoor passions and have that career path that just easily slid into.
Totally. So what kind of ski trip would you do with your unit? I mean, would recreational skiing just to keep tuned up?
Oh, yeah. Kluna Traverse. I don't know if you remember. Had to be 7-8 years ago, the plane crash up at above the Kinnick Glacier at the very top where it rolled mm-hmm. over in Prince William Sound at the pass. Then a helicopter went up there to do the recovery, and that helicopter crashed. Well, that was PJs. They got put in lower because of the weather and had to ski up there. Took them overnight to ski to the crash site. They spent, I think, two more nights with the survivors of the crashes before we can get more aircraft in to get them all out. So we justified our skiing right there with saving some lives and plane crash.
Yeah. So I'm interested in these guys that you skied with in the military mm-hmm. who are super professional elites. Now you're skiing as a powder guide. Mm-hmm. And I imagine it's a pretty broad skill range that you get among your clients. How do you adjust for that? Or how do you deal with those sort of skill differences and teaching and developing people, making sure they have fun and stuff like that as a heli skiing guide?
It's I've found that when you go and meet your clients the first time, and you're right, the skill set and the range of them is all over the place. Most of them are good skiers. That's why they're there to heli ski.
Right.
And but you gotta paint the picture, like expectations, right? Have clear expectations of what the day is gonna be like. So there's no, they can't go there thinking that it's going to be just like the ski movie, right? And hucking cliffs snow over their head on every turn and things like that. So you got to give them clear expectations of the day. And some people, had a client the other day that only made it half a day, and we flew him out at the lunch, just exhausted, right? It's a lot of, by lunch we had 10,000 vertical feet, and he's tired.
Because most people ski at the resort, just ski a run, have a beer,
exactly.
Ski a little bit more, yeah. Yeah.
And here we are halfway through the day and
you're skiing hard all day.
Skiing hard, right? You're tops to bottom, 3,000 foot runs and back in the helicopter, go do it again.
Sounds like heaven, though.
Oh, it's so good. So good. Everyone should do it. He had a exhausting day and then he went home a little bit early, but he still had a great time. I mean, at lunch, he was going back, he's shaking hands, just saying what a great time he had and just needed to get more ski days in.
Yeah. So when you look back over your career and the accidents you've seen and the problems you've mm-hmm. seen, are there any patterns there or any sort of advice you'd have for people who are not experts like you as to like how to be safe, how to avoid the kinds of mishaps you've seen. Obviously, having a heart attack in the middle of the Pacific Ocean is not something you can avoid. But do you see any patterns in sort of the things that go wrong?
You know, the biggest pattern you see is that human factor, right? Where we get so excited, the snow just fall. We just got this big dump the other day, and people are going to be racing to get out there, and not doing the homework, right? The wind that followed it, that snow coming upside down. You know, the avalanche dangers. And sometimes not stepping back and looking at all the pieces.
Which is a professional is what you learn to do.
Is what you do, yeah. You got to look at all the pieces and piece together. And it's hard to do, right? Yeah, that takes experience, right? You look at the avalanche forecast. Get to know weather and weather patterns. Go out with friends that also have experience or a mentor. Get a mentor to take you out a few times and look for those telltale signs that this isn't a great day to be out. Let's let this settle for a day or so.
Yeah.
And you can apply that little bit of experience, a little just stepping back and looking at it from a big picture and not just from an emotional or excited. You can look at it from climbing, skiing, and all these outdoor sports and probably reduce some of our accidents that we do end up having.
Yeah. Well, something you're saying is striking me that I was thinking about. This guy must have incredible skills. He must have amazing experience. He must have amazing fitness. But something else you must have gotten from the military is leadership, which can be so important in any kind of outdoor situation. That's sort of the sense of how to sort of calmly express to others what really needs to happen.
I find it comes into play often when guiding. Sometimes the clients sometimes want to lead the guide, right? And they're so excited and having some leadership skills and being unemotional and just factual, you know, you kind of put things back in perspective. And that's where it's really good to meet them early and have clear picture of what the day is going to be like. And the day goes smoother every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's something that I guess comes with a lot of experience and a lot of responsibility. Because if you're out there, you're rescuing somebody, but you're also responsible for your guys and all these amazing aircraft and everything else. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone should go heli skiing.
Everyone should go heli skiing, right? Well, as long as they're good skiers to begin with,
yes,
right?
Yeah, it helps.
Yeah, absolutely. So it sounds like I'm just going to imagine young people listening to the radio right now saying, I want to be a PJ, but you got to be pretty good.
You know, it's a long road, that's for sure. And it's an amazing career path. It'll open up the doors to a lot of things.
And
I would tell no one, everyone should that's interested in it should look into it, do their research, do their homework, and 'cause 2 years is a long pipeline. It's a long time.
Once you get into it, you're gonna want to stay.
Yeah, I'm gonna be there for a while.
Oh, great! Thank you so much, David. David Schumann, who is a guide with Chugach Powder Guides. And spent 25 years in the U.S. military. Thank you for your service. And,
thank you.
And for all the people that you've rescued. Amazing number of lives you must have saved. So thanks for being on Outdoor Explorer today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And that's all for today's show. Thanks also to my first guest, Kirk Alkier, who's doing his work and is renamed Gold Star Peak. The producer of Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolfarth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.